Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at reprieverc.com. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery. It's an all-women's facility up in Morgan. I think they've got up to 12 beds, and it's an amazing place to go find recovery, to help heal yourself, and just kind of help you along the way. And if you want more information about them, go to ReprieveRC.com. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley.
You know, Reprieve is in the most beautiful valley in the state.
Morgan?
Yeah.
Morgan's a beautiful valley, but I don't know how you quantify that.
No, it's because I said it's the most beautiful valley.
I know you're a doctor. You know what I mean? And I think what you say, you know, carries
I'm partial because I grew up there.
Carries a certain amount
and
of
I'm,
weight.
And I'm very proud that they have that up there in Morgan.
For those of our listeners who are outside of the state of Utah, Utah is an amazing, beautiful state. So much that, I mean, you've got everything and more here. And Europeans come over and spend months at a time going from one edge of the state to the other.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm going down south this weekend and get to be in the Red Rocks and hike the desert canyons. And then you can be up in Morgan, up in the ski slopes and all that.
Or you can go up to northern Utah and be the Caribbean of the Rockies, which is the Bear Lake.
Bear Lake, it's
just a beautiful, I mean, it really is. And I'm surprised, you know, for the longest time, my job as a TV reporter was this thing called road tripping.
Yeah, I remember that.
Take people all over the state. And I was always amazed of how many people who lived in Utah had not went out and ventured in their own backyard.
That is true.
You know, yeah, went down true. To Zion, went down to Moab, went to Goblin Valley, went up to Bear Lake. World-class ski resorts are littered here in the state of Utah.
Oh, yeah, the best.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
So if you ever get a chance, come to Utah. Plus, we got some great recovery centers like Reprieve.
Actually, we really do. That's really true. And mental health, while it can always improve more, the state of Utah has a lot of great mental health facilities, including recovery facilities.
You know, there's been a lot of guests who have come from the East Coast out here to Utah to find recovery and ended up staying.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they were like, this is just so beautiful. I mean, the hikes are amazing and the people are so nice. I mean, it reminds me of my first years up in college when we'd get these people who'd come from the East Coast. Inevitably, it was the first month and a half. They're like, what is this place?
Yeah.
This is, I do not like it. And then after 3 months, 4 months, they find their groove and they're like, I'm never leaving.
It's a different pace of life, but it's nice.
It really is. Oh. Hey, what we're going to do is we're going to start out the podcast. We're going to do a little cleaning, if you will. We're going to clean up. Yep, we're going to catch people up. So okay. I'm going to start with, you remember the guy who backed into my girlfriend's car?
I do. Well, I know the story. I remember the story. You were out at a bar.
Uh-huh.
And you weren't drinking,
nope.
Of course.
Designated driver. DD.
And then what happened?
This guy backed into her car and then left.
Yep.
Then I played Scooby-Doo and went to the tape and talked to people in the bar, got his number.
Within minutes. You had his phone number and his name.
And Facebook page. And so I called him.
Yeah, you're like a Hardy Boy.
He's like, who's this? And I go, this is the guy's car you just backed into. He goes, I did not. I go, really? Because I've got video.
Yeah. Because we have proof.
Then he threatened to fight me.
Right.
And I was like, I don't want to. He had been drinking. Yeah. I was like, I don't want to fight you.
Right.
I told him I didn't want to call the cops because I didn't want to get him in any more trouble.
Right.
He thanked me for it.
He should. Yeah.
Called me the next morning and we got on a payment plan and then life happened.
Life happens sometimes.
And that's okay. And me and my girlfriend, and it's mostly my girlfriend because it was her car, has been very cooperating with him, you know, and everything's been kind of cool. And
did he make some payments?
He did make some payments.
Oh, that's good.
And then life happened and Christmas happened. And so we kind of put them on hold. And the goal was then to get paid off when he gets his tax return.
Okay.
So my girlfriend hit me up yesterday. She's like, hey.
Tax season.
Let's call the guy. So I texted him. And I'll just read you my text.
Okay.
And I'm not doing this to put him on blast. I'm just showing you kind of what goes on with the disease and how it can affect people. Here's my text. Hope things are going better. dot, dot, dot. I'm the king of dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because if I don't know a question mark or period, I go dot, dot, dot.
It's a good substitute.
Hope things are going better, dot, dot, dot. Just wanted to reach out and touch base and see if you might be able to start making payments again.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah, and so I sent that text thinking I'll probably get a response in 1 or 2 days. Instantaneously, the bubbles popped up.
Oh.
So I'm waiting with bated breath. I'm at the gym.
Yeah.
You know, man, I was really thinking about you yesterday. Just got out of jail literally last night around 8:30. I'm checking myself into rehab on Monday. Drinking had gotten out of control, and now I'm facing new charges. I'm going to get info on rehab right now, and I'll keep you posted. I'm sorry, brother, for real. My life kind of flipped upside quick.
Hmm.
And then he adds, I will pay you sooner than later.
There you go.
Thanks for being understanding. But the thing that really got me in that is drinking gotten out of control, and now I'm facing new charges. Yeah. My life got upside pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And that part I relate to kind of, but not now, because I've got some sobriety under my belt. Mm-hmm. Life didn't get out of control. It had been getting out of control for a while. Right. A lot of times an addict will tell you that all of a sudden it just got out of control.
Yeah.
No, it had gotten out of control a while ago. If it's to this point where you're facing new charges and stuff like that, things have been going downhill for a while.
It's been a problem for a while.
But a lot of times as an addict, we're the last person to know, which is crazy because we're right. The one doing all the work.
Well, it's that denial factor of thinking, oh, I'm keeping it together. I'm fine.
I remember when I finally told people that I was an alcoholic, they were like, yeah, we knew.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, tell us something we don't know.
You weren't fooling anybody, you know.
And except yourself.
There was this one time that I was working at the other news station and things weren't going good. And I was in the middle of a divorce and. The drinking had really gotten out of control. And I remember standing in the newsroom and a friend of mine, he was a director. And I was just, and this pops into my mind all the time. I'm standing in the newsroom and he comes up to me. He's like, hey, Case. And I go, hey. He goes, how you doing? I go, good. He goes, really, how are you doing?
Mm.
And I go, good. And he goes, okay. If you need something, let me know.
Yeah.
And he walked off. And I remember being in my head, what's he talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
How does he know?
No, not
you
that.
You didn't even think that?
No, not even that. I was just like.
You were in such denial.
Such
you were
denial
like,
that I was like, I wonder what's he talking about?
Do I got a stain on my shirt?
Yeah. I mean, like my performance has been well, I thought. You know what I mean? What's going on? I was, and it wasn't until I got sober that I was like, oh.
He knew.
Yeah. He was throwing me a lifeline.
Yeah.
And trying to gingerly, without overstepping his boundaries, but he was trying to let me know that he was there for me.
Yeah.
And now that I look back with sobriety underneath me, I know that there was a lot of people that extended that lifeline that threw me a lifesaver.
Because they could see there was a problem. They knew something was wrong.
But how do you approach somebody like that when they're not willing to admit it themselves?
Right. Right.
How do you interject you?
Well, I think you do it the way he did it.
And
he's direct, but without being accusatory. And he was telling you that he was available if you needed something. Because I think that's what you have to do is make yourself available to a person who's struggling, because it's not really going to work until they're ready to take the help you're offering.
Now think about this. If he'd have came up to me and said, hey, you've been drinking a little too much. I can smell it on you right now.
You have
now.
A drinking problem.
I would have been defensive.
Yep.
I would have been argumentative.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have called him out. And it was like, really, you want to talk about me? Let's talk about you.
Yeah.
Because that's what an addict does.
Right.
Deflects.
Yeah.
And changes the subject and forces the light on a different subject. Because, so you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You know what I mean? Yeah. Really, I mean, it's like, I don't know what the right, and I think you're right. I think you do exactly what my friend did.
I think you don't, I think it's a mistake to do nothing.
That's probably the biggest mistake.
I think if you care about somebody and you recognize they're struggling, you kind of do something like he did where you let it. I like the best part of what he said was, no, really, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Because he was pushing past your initial normal defensiveness, or that's just a greeting. Hey, how are you doing? He was pushing past that and trying to get let you know gently that he knew that you needed something. And I think that's a good friend. It's a good colleague. It's a good coworker, you know.
All right. So I've got some information about our good friend Seneca.
Okay.
Who passed away probably a little over a month and a half ago. Mm-hmm. He was on the podcast. He was homeless for many years on Skid Row in L.A.
Yeah.
He came back, found sobriety, and
for people who heard the show, he was the
auctioneer.
Auctioneer. Yeah. Yeah. And he did a little of that on the show. It was impressive.
And his former mother-in-law is a friend of the show and a friend of mine. And she lost her daughter to alcoholism less than a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And her name was Gretchen. And she was married to Seneca. And they divorced, but she's always been in both of their lives. And right now she is the primary caregiver for their daughter, Indy.
Okay.
And so when we first announced Seneca's passing, we weren't sure of exactly what had happened. We knew that he would probably want us to talk about it because recovery was very important to him.
Yeah.
But we had found out that he'd relapsed. So she sent me a DM, and so I'm just going to read it to you. Here we go. Let me find it. And she says, dang it. Hold on. Okay. Just wanted to DM you and let you know Seneca's toxicology results came back. It was alcohol and fentanyl. Mm-hmm. Coroner's report, accidental overdose. She goes on to say, this is breaking my heart. I so wish I could help people overcome their addictions. First my Gretchen and now my Seneca. Thank you for everything you do to try and help. Indica is doing well and the best she can. Thank you for everything that you do for the community. And so I just reached back. And what we are planning on doing somewhere in the first couple weeks of June is having a celebration of life for Seneca.
Good.
And I will mention it on the podcast, and we'll have his daughter there and his family and friends, and do a lantern launch or a balloon launch, and let people come and celebrate his life. Because if one thing we know about Seneca is he loved to have friends around.
Yeah.
And so I think they would love to come around and share some stories about him.
And he did so much good for so many people.
He did. He was an amazing individual, and we were lucky to call him a friend. All right, so I've got one more message
update
that I'm going to read.
Okay.
And then this is going to play into our guest today.
All right.
Now, I received this message October 26, 2021.
All right.
Hey, Casey, I love what you're doing. I saw your post with Tyler Gould, and it was awesome. I'm an Irish-born recovering poly addict and a musician who attributes his sobriety to rediscovering his passion for writing music. I would love to know how to get involved with you guys and share some of my music or my story in an effort to help any other people struggling with addiction or mental health issues. Thank you for your time, and I hope to hear from you soon. His name is Scott Devine. Do you remember writing that?
I don't remember writing that. I remember sending it to you. Like, I remember messaging you, but I never expected a response really after about a month. So.
And before the podcast started, we were talking about it, and you said something that was kind of interesting. You said maybe the reason you sent that was what?
Yeah. I think I've always struggled with narcissism a little bit, and I was really proud of myself. I was about 4 months sober at the time that I sent that, and I thought I had it all figured out. And even in my sobriety, I've had to do a lot of personal development that has nothing to do with the decision to stop drinking. And so, it just kind of struck me as I was driving up here today that the timing is very interesting, because after 3 years and a lot of humbling life lessons, I feel like I wouldn't have really even had that much to contribute to the conversation at that point. I was proud of myself, and I was...
You should be.
Seeing a lot of changes. Yeah, yeah, definitely. But it was more just of an ego thing. And I actually know Tyler. We used to work together and play a little music. And I think part of me kind of saw what he was doing, and I kind of wanted to kind of be a part of that too. And it was definitely ego-driven and based out of more wanting to be the center of attention rather than actually providing something useful to people.
So do you think your story today will be different than your story of 3 years ago would have been?
Yeah, for sure. I've been through a lot in the last 3 years that have kind of changed my circumstances. And I've been humbled a lot by life. I feel grateful. I've recently kind of discovered my relationship with God a little bit more, which is interesting because a lot of people will lean heavily on God to get sober. And I was sober for maybe 2 years before I decided to open my heart to God. And I get kind of emotional about it sometimes because it feels like the amount of blessings that have been poured out in my life in the last 6 months are just something I've never experienced before.
Well, this is going to be an interesting podcast. Scott Devine, Project Recovery. We'll be back in just a few seconds. And welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is Scott Devine, who in June will be celebrating 3 years of sobriety.
Yeah, 3 years. Thank
Crazy.
God.
Yeah. Do you remember when you first got sober? I'm sure you're like a lot of us. Like the first year was the big milestone.
Yeah.
And you said you reached out to us at 4 months thinking that you had it figured out.
Yeah.
And when you got to that year, what was your thought?
I mean, I definitely wanted some credit, to be honest. I'm still in my kind of narcissistic phase. A milestone like that is pretty incredible for me. I mean, for anybody, but I couldn't get 24 hours for a long time. I don't know if you guys can relate, but you wake up in the morning filled with regret, made a bunch of horrible decisions, broke promises, and it's like, all right, I just got to get through to the end of the day. If I can get through to the end of the day, then I'll go to sleep, and by the time I wake up, I'll have 24 hours.
Yeah.
And I just could not get home from work without stopping at the gas station or the liquor store or whatever. So,
You know, for me in the end, in my addiction, it was crazy. It was habitual. You know, I mean, it's so much in the fact that my first two times at a gas station while I was in rehab, because they would take us there to get soda pops.
Yeah.
I would walk straight back to the beer cooler. Mm. And I remember the guys
on autopilot.
Yeah, yeah. The guys who were watching was like, hey, what are you doing back there? No, you know what I mean? Because they got that little beer cooler.
They got the cold cave.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was like, but it was just habitual. You know what I mean? It was just, I go in there and I grab it and I come out and that's what it was.
Yeah,
and
so, autopilot. Yeah, for sure.
It's funny you say that.
But that was my jam.
Yeah. Mine was I lived next to a Walmart down in Provo for a while. And I swear 90% of my trips were just down that one aisle.
Yeah.
Where there's like the beer. And I remember after I was
you know,
sober.
They sell clothing where you get beer.
Yeah, and tires.
They have tires at the beer store?
Yeah, that's crazy.
But I remember walking down that aisle once I had some sobriety. I think I was like maybe getting some soda. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized I hadn't been down that aisle in a year. And I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of forgot about this place. And I try to avoid it. I mean, at this point, you know, I have some roommates that drink. We're trying to kind of help them in whatever way we can. But being around it doesn't really affect me as much. But
and, you know, and neither does it affect me. And, you know, it's crazy because people are like, if you wanted to drink, I wouldn't let you drink. And I go, I appreciate the sentiment. That's very nice
of
you.
You couldn't stop me, though.
And I go, and as a matter of fact, Maverick couldn't stop me. Yeah. Walmart couldn't stop me.
Right.
Because my picture's not hanging up in there saying, do not sell alcohol to this guy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's still legal. And if I want to, I can. And so I remember, because some of you might remember this story, some of you might not, is that we were sitting in rehab and this one guy in the process group was like, I can't go downtown. I can't go here because that's where I used to buy heroin. I go, well, that just sounds stupid. Yeah. I get that you don't want to go down there and for the purposes of buying it. But when we get done with this, we're going to go to a gas station, which is my dealer. When I have to go get food for my kids, that is my dealer.
Yeah, everywhere you go.
You know what I mean? So you've got to figure out a way to navigate this world. I mean, I'm not saying put yourself in harm. Don't walk around, you know.
Don't give yourself undue temptation. But
you
don't want to have your life become this limited play, you know, of where you can and can't go. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, and that takes me back to my original thoughts when I got sober. Is I got sober to live, not sober to hide. And I know a lot of people that are hiding in their sobriety.
Yeah.
And a prisoner.
Kind of a white knuckling style,
sure.
Yeah.
So before we get to what the cool things you're doing now in recovery, Scott, where does the story of Scott begin?
So Dublin, Ireland, 1987. My mom and my dad are both alcoholics. My mom's in recovery. She's a LDS full member. She hasn't drank in 30, 40 years or something at this point. I was born in Ireland. We joined the church. We immigrated to America in 1994 to a small town in Nevada called Alamo, which is a really great place, really close-knit LDS community mostly, 90%. And I wasn't really exposed to a lot there. There
did
was
you
like,
come to the United States because you had joined the church? Or?
Yeah, okay. yeah. In 1994, economically and kind of a lot of crazy stuff happened. A guy had burned himself alive in our neighborhood. He committed suicide. There was all sorts of drug addiction, and there was just no real future for my sisters and I. I'm the youngest of four. I have four older sisters. And so coming to America, it's funny because back when BYU Idaho was Rick's college, they had a world-renowned clog dancing team.
Mm-hmm.
and their clog dancing team used to travel around the world. And that's how my oldest sister, Kim, who was 16 when we first came to America, that's how she decided on going to Rick's college, was because that's where the clog dancing team is. And so that's how we found out about that. And all my sisters and I, coincidentally or ironically, went to BYU Idaho as well.
For clogging?
I wish. I did clog. I'm a champion clogger.
Right,
I mean, well, right. I should say I have some trophies from the county fair and stuff like that. I went to Tuacon when I was a little kid and put on. So,
but you moved to a small town, Alamo, which is probably a pretty safe place.
Super safe. Super nice. I just remember there was a senior missionary couple. So we were active members in the church. And Mary Lou and Clark Hardy, which it probably doesn't get more American than that, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, right? Yeah.
but they lived in Alamo, and their daughter was kind of a real estate agent, and their son-in-law had a principal of a high school or something like that. And so before we ever came to America, they were talking to us like, you guys got to come to Alamo, like, you know. And my mom, with the Irish ties to Boston and the East Coast, I think she had kind of always thought, if I go to America, I'll probably go somewhere like that. So it's super weird that we ended up where we ended up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a really great place. Very safe, little bit of drinking out by the campfire, you know, when you're like 14 or something like that. I think that was kind of like my first exposure to alcohol, really, was, hanging out with some of the seniors and drinking and kind of making a fool of myself. And, I kind of fed into that.
When you were a young kid, did you suffer from anxiety? Did you have a pretty normal childhood? I mean, I got to imagine coming from Ireland to a small town in Nevada, you had to have some sort of rock star status. I mean, did you have a little bit of an accent? And...
So I've lost my accent, unfortunately, but I had a little bit of an accent when I got here, and I had long blonde hair. Why, God, did you do this to me?
And now if you can't see him, he's completely bald.
Totally bald.
Shaven.
Yeah, completely. But I had this long blonde hair. And I mean, you're kind of, it's small town America. I think people aren't always as welcoming to outsiders as you'd like to think. I did feel a bit ostracized, but there were some really good people that were always just, I mean, that's one of the best places I've ever been in my life. And I grew up there, and I love it to this day. My mom still lives there.
How old were you when you came to America?
Between 6 and 7, almost 7.
Okay. And do you remember how you felt about leaving? I mean, it's not like you're moving from Utah to Idaho. You're going all the way across the world. How did you, was it exciting? Was it scary? What did you think?
Yeah, I was really excited. My mom said that I started to get an American accent before I came here.
Getting ready. Huh?
I was really excited. I don't think I understood the implications, but one of the things I love about my mom is I remember us all sitting down in this tiny little camper van we were living in the middle of a field. We had left Dublin. When we decided we were going to move to America, we had left Dublin and gone down to the country to a place called Wexford. And that's kind of where she would go on her summer vacations when she was a kid. And we had a friend who had, it wasn't even called a field, they called it a paddock. Mm-hmm. And we had a little trailer that we stayed in. And eventually we sold the trailer and to get our tickets and everything like that. We sold all our belongings on the street. We used to busk as a family. And
clogging?
There's always an underlying clogging part of the story, just for sure.
Definitely.
I was wearing clogging shoes when I came here, but no, when we moved into the little camper, I remember her sitting us down. I was, I don't know, 4 or 5. I really don't remember it firsthand, but I remember my sisters and I, my mom just asked us, like, we're going to take a vote as a family. And if anyone, even tiny little Scott, doesn't want to go, like, we won't go. And we were all on board. I'm going to get emotional. I love my family very much. And we've always been a team, you know, so.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So everybody said yes.
Yeah, we all said yeah.
I like that. I like the fact that your parents kind of recognized the gravity of such a big family decision, and they included everybody in that.
And family is important. And
yeah, so absolutely.
You come over here and 6 or 7 years old, grew up there. How was high school?
High school, I did everything I could to make people dislike me unintentionally and intentionally. I don't really know. My mom got married. My dad's still in Ireland to this day. He never came over with us.
Oh.
He still lives in Dublin. Yeah, when we came over, my mom ended up getting married when I was in seventh grade or sixth or seventh grade, and we needed to move to Las Vegas, which Alamo is about 100 miles from Las Vegas. It's just west of the I-15, like by, 100 miles. And we had to go live in Las Vegas for 2 years. So that was kind of interesting because those were some of my formative years, like 12, 13. Yeah. And so I had been in elementary school in Alamo and then sixth grade. And then we moved to Vegas in seventh and eighth grade. And then I think we sold the house or whatever and then moved back to Alamo. And the summer before my freshman year, my friend and I broke into the gym in high school and I threw a golf club through the backboard accidentally.
Through the glass backboard.
Yeah, through the glass backboard. I was trying to throw it. But I was trying to hit the backboard. And I was spinning around and I watched it almost in slow motion. And my friend's big brother was on the basketball team and he was there with us and he was like, you guys aren't like, I was going to run. I wasn't going to tell anybody. I'm like, let them fingerprint the golf club. Like, I'm not copping to this. But we went over to the coach's house that night and he was so upset and the principal and everything like that. And so I kind of had this really bad reputation and I kind of embraced it just foolishly like a 14-year-old would. Like I kind of thought I was a bad A or whatever for being in Vegas in middle school and kind of like, I've been to the big city, like you country folks don't get it. And so, I mean, I was kind of a punk, you know what I mean? And I completely lacked humility in every single way. You know, and I wasn't a very kind person. I really, most of my life, I've been so obsessed with myself and what I need and what I want that I really haven't been very good to people. And there's a lot of times, there's a few people that have reached out to me post high school that I was particularly cruel to, you know, and we've gone back and forth and one of them actually passed away. And before he died, he was able to forgive me. And that was really special.
So you were trying to make some amends.
Yeah, definitely. Always.
So when did you start drinking kind of more than just recreational?
Yeah. So when I went up to – so I left high school in Alamo and went directly to BYU, Idaho, you know, with every intention of trying to try everything.
Mean alcohol and drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which doesn't seem like the school to go to for that.
Right.
For those who don't know, that's an LDS school, you know, which frowns upon drugs and alcohol.
UNLV was right in your backyard.
Yeah,
you could have gone there.
For sure. So
Sin City, they call it, you know?
No, not to throw my mom under the bus, but I was 17 when I graduated high school. So my entire senior year, I was not able to sign my own college applications. I think my mom knew that if I went to Las Vegas, like things were going to be bad. I had friends that went to UNLV or CCSN, Community College of Southern Nevada, Dixie, you know, SUU or whatever. But all my sisters had gone to BYU Idaho. So my mom made a deal with me. She was like, if you go and you go for one semester and you don't like it, you can come home. And the day before I graduated, we were setting up chairs for the graduation and I had a freak accident where a little cart ran into the back of my foot and actually severed my Achilles tendon.
Oh my
God. So my first semester up at school, I was on crutches and it took me like, you know, 9 months to recover from that. But, I mean, I went up there with the intention of trying to find bad apples. I was looking for people who I was, you know, there was really no weed in Alamo, right? Like guys would, the worst that people really did was like drinking out by the fire. Everybody's like really good people out there. I think it's gotten a little bit different because the world is just changing and more people have moved in from other places and it's kind of, you know, worked out that way. But yeah, when I went up to Rexburg, I was like, okay, this is my opportunity, right?
Why do you think that was your intent? I'm just curious. Like that's very specific.
Yeah.
Very intentional.
Yeah.
What do you think it was about you at that time in your life where you're like, I want to try everything?
Yeah, it was total rebellion. It was total rebellion against my mother. She had a very strict parenting style, and she used to use the analogy of a sapling. And she's so different than this now, and she's literally apologized to me, which has changed our relationship. We're honestly more like friends than a mother and a son. She's like one of my best friends. But at the time, you know, and you're talking about a single mother who's raising five children, four girls in a row, and then you get this little POS, right?
Yeah.
And so she didn't know what she was doing. You know what I mean? And she just did the best that she knew how to do. But she used to use this analogy of a sapling, right? If you tie down a sapling for long enough and you hold it in place, when you eventually remove the strap, it'll stay that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to say, well, I'm going to like bounce the other way 100%. So
it was trying to tie you down.
Yeah, it was just a rebellion thing. Really.
But I think Scott going to college with the idea of trying everything is not so extreme. I think there's a lot of people who go and do that.
Yeah.
But I don't think...
they go to BYU, Idaho.
Yeah.
I met every single person that did, though. I was able to find all the bad apples, the 1%.
So you go up there, the first 9 months you were on crutches. Did you find what you were looking for?
Yeah. I ended up, I was 18. I moved in with, there was five return missionaries. I think the youngest was 24. And I thought they were ancient. You know what I mean? I was like, these guys are so old and out of touch. And they were all good, solid guys. So none of them were going to be, you know, they were over 21. So
they were going to buy you beer.
You're right. Because in Alamo, we used to just get the truck driver, right? We'd just go knock on his door and be like, hey, here's like $40. And then he would buy us $10 worth of beer and keep 30 or whatever. None of these guys would have bought me alcohol. And I was scared. Like, I mean, you sign the honor code when you go up there. So you agree to not do those sort of things. And then you also, as part of the honor code, you're kind of encouraged to report people that do, you know what I mean? To preserve the kind of sanctity of that place. So I wasn't going to ask those guys. And I actually met my best friend who's, I'm not going to say his name, but the addiction recovery counselor with the master's degree
in
psychology who currently does like assessments and helps people with treatment. He was the first person that I really met. He came over because he had grown up, I think, with some of my roommates in California. And I was like, oh, this guy's from California. Like, he's cool, you know, and he's the No Effects guy, the punk rock guy. He's like showing me Fat Records, and we're like smoking cigarettes in his truck and, you know, buying beer and all that stuff. So, yeah, I found what I was looking for through him. But he's one of my best friends to this day. He got sober a long time before I did. He's been sober for 10 years or so. Yeah.
So... how was the partying up there? I mean, did it get out of control quick, or was it a slow burn?
Kind of all the above. It was really interesting. Like I'd like to say I didn't care, but I think I was just so careless and oblivious to how obvious it must have been. Like, I remember smoking cigarettes and then coming back inside. Imagine someone smoking cigarettes and coming into like a room with a bunch of return missionaries and expecting no one to notice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I would put my sweater in the closet and spray cologne. And then, eventually they went to my landlord. My landlord pulled me down and was like, hey, so these guys are saying, you know, you've been smoking, you've been doing this, you've been doing whatnot, and what's the deal with that? And I was just lying, you know, I was like, no, that's crazy. I've never done that. But eventually, I mean, I did get kicked out of BYU Idaho. I went and I sat. Every year you go to what's called an ecclesiastical endorsement, and you'll talk to your bishop, and he'll kind of give you the approval to go back to school for the next year. It's kind of like an interview. And, you know, I do believe in the power of discernment. You know, any righteous person or any person who's kind of doing what they should be doing is going to be able to tell whether you're being honest or not. And he, you know, I looked that man in the eyes and lied to him completely, felt no guilt either. It was just like, I got to do whatever it takes to stay in school. And he was like, you know, Scott, there's this thing called the power of discernment. And I kind of feel like you're not being completely honest with me. So I'll tell you what, why don't you take the summer off? There was three blocks. So I'd gone up there kind of summer, second block, fall. I think I'd had the winter off. And then going into maybe May or something like that, I was meeting with him. And he's like, I think you should take the summer off. Why don't you come back in the fall and kind of see how you're doing? And so I went and I did some door-to-door sales, but I never went back to BYU Idaho after that. I went back to Rexburg to, you know, because I had friends up there and all my connects and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that was kind of the end of that.
Here's an interesting BYU culture thing that you may not know, Casey. So I went to BYU Provo.
Okay.
And so if you are a BYU student, at any point while you're a student, you have to live in BYU-approved housing. Whether it's on campus in the dorms or off campus in an apartment. And the people like, this is the landlord thing, because listeners might be like, well, why does the landlord
right,
care if you're
right,
doing that
yeah,
kind
exactly.
of stuff, right?
He just cares about his money.
Yeah, he just wants to get paid. But that's with normal colleges. But at BYU, that landlord has to show that he meets all the criteria for BYU-approved housing all the time. Like every year they have to up it and re-up it. And so he had to like make sure that the people living in his place weren't violating the what's called the honor code.
Yeah.
And the honor code is essentially following the rules of the church and a few other things. And one of those is no drugs or alcohol, cigarettes. And so that's why.
Okay.
That makes sense. If you go to BYU Hawaii or BYU Provo or BYU Idaho, you have to live in BYU approved.
You should
housing.
Expect your landlord to be fully in your business.
Yeah.
You
know? Which at any
pros
other
and
college,
cons to that, right,
they would be like, you know, just don't burn the place down and pay me every month. Right?
Yeah.
So while you were up in Rexburg, Idaho, another small town, was it just alcohol or were you venturing into other drugs?
So I never really got into anything other than just weed. You know what I mean? We were smoking quite a bit. And that was not really. I mean, I don't think it really turned into a problem. If you want to know the truth, I don't really think I became the worst, my worst addiction and the worst phases of my drinking and, you know, drug use and stuff like that were post-rehab, post my second stint in rehab.
Let's get to the first one. What brought you to the first rehab?
The first rehab. I definitely went for the wrong reasons, right? I was dating a girl and I had... Just a couple of months after being with her, I got a DUI, and I had kind of pushed off the court date for a long time. Right, I got the DUI in May. I didn't end up finally going to court for it until December, and right before going into court, I had kind of like done some research online. I was like, hey, like if you go to rehab, like maybe you can avoid the jail time, and also, I mean, I. Everybody, it's like you said, like everybody knew you were an alcoholic before you did.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who knew me knew I had a problem. I'm so compulsive and impulsive, and I've always just made decisions kind of right there. And she had encouraged me to go, and I don't think there's a wrong reason to get your foot in the door. I don't think there's any wrong reason or any bad reason to get in the door, but it's like the cliche, you know, like you cannot do it for someone else. You can't do it for your kids, your mom. I broke my mother's heart, you know, and my mom has been through a lot. My mom was homeless in London when she was 14. She ran away from home and lived on the streets like in the 60s and saw everything and went through everything. And so for her to work as hard as she did to get where she was at and have us in this safe little place and have me up at BYU Idaho and then have me just completely go off the rails. I know that was heartbreaking for her, you know?
So while in rehab for the first time, you said for the wrong reason, but the right place.
Yeah.
Did you listen or were you just kind of killing time?
Oh yeah. No, I was like trying to educate people on life and tell them like how they should live their lives and stuff like that. I thought I was kind of an expert on everything.
I met a couple guys like that.
Yeah.
And you're actually listening to one right now because I was that guy too for a bit.
My mom calls it know all, no F all.
Yeah.
So.
And so you're in there and you said it really didn't get out of control until you got out. Now that seems weird.
Yeah. Counterintuitive, right? So I would think I went to rehab the first time in December of 2019. I actually spent Christmas and New Year's in a residential facility down in Springville. And I got out, I was sober for about 4 or 5 days. I was staying in a hotel. While I was in rehab, my roommate, who like thought I was a fool for going to rehab because he was in his active addiction, he had moved a girl into my room. So I came home from rehab, and both times I only went for 30 days, and I would, you know, I would never give anybody advice, but that was not enough time. Obviously, I think a lot of people, you know, would say like 90 plus or 6 months or whatever, but both times was like 30 to 45 days. And when I had gotten out, he'd moved someone into my room, and I was like, "Hey, where's my green card and my social security card that was in my top drawer of my dresser that now has this woman's underwear in it?" He was like, "Oh, it's out in the shed in the back." So I ended up getting all my stuff, and I was staying at a hotel. I was there for like 4 or 5 days, and old habits die hard, you know what I mean? And hotels, from personal experience and also from hearing other people say this, they're very triggering, obviously, because a lot of people do drugs and drink alcohol in hotels. So as a sober person, that's maybe not something you associate with when you first walk into a hotel room, but we all know what a hotel room looks like. Everybody, they all kind of look the same. And for me, I mean, I don't have the temptation to drink anymore, but I still kind of feel like it's a place where I should be drinking.
Mm. So, I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that association between that intense behavior.
So you relapsed.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I've kind of joked around and blamed it on Kobe's death. As I was watching the news, my girlfriend and I had just gotten into a fight. So she left. And so this was like my first fight post-rehab. So that's very tumultuous. And people in relationships really struggle with that because a lot of times the main source of your frustration or pain in your life might be your relationship. And so, yeah, she and I had gotten into an argument. I was sitting there in my hotel room. Kobe died, and I wasn't even a Lakers fan. It was really weird, but I got emotional, and I was crying. And I walked over to that same Walmart and just got some beers. And, I mean, I didn't tie when all the liquor stores are closed at, like, 7 o'clock in Provo. But that drinking led to my second stay in rehab.
Now, we're not joking about Kobe dying, but the fact that, I mean, Kobe dying and an addict— I mean, you can find an excuse in just about anything.
For sure.
And you can sell it to yourself to where it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, now with some sobriety in here, not being a Lakers fan and all that stuff, you can understand, you know, that it was kind of far out there. But when you're in the thick of it, any little thing is a reason for you to drink.
Well, I think it sometimes triggers unresolved things inside of you. So it was a sad situation. Whether you're a Lakers fan or not, you know, that whole story and his daughter being there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a sad situation.
Super tragic.
And so sometimes being around sadness triggers our unresolved feelings of sadness, anger, frustration.
Yeah.
And and like you said, then it's like, oh, we can point to that event and say that's what caused it.
That's profound. I feel like people will do that with anything. Like, that guy pissed me off, or like, whatever. It really is. You want to drink, and that's just the threshold.
In my act of addiction, I could manipulate a conversation with my ex-wife within 3 moves, having her being mad at me and me run to the gas station for beer.
You're like, oh, she's mad at me, so now I have a reason to drink.
In my head, I knew. I was playing chess and she was playing checkers.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. She's going to tell me to get out, and I will be in the car, and I will be at the gas station. And guess what? It's not my fault. It's hers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you want to talk about narcissistic, you want
Don't
to talk about
me.
Manipulative. You want that was me.
Well, that's the addict mind.
Yeah. So you said after that it was off to the races. And this is when it really got bad?
I mean, it got the worst it ever got was after rehab the second time.
So how many times have you been to rehab?
Twice.
Okay. So the first time you went, and then the second time?
Yeah. Yeah. So the first time was in December of 2019. I got out at the end of January, relapsed basically at the end of, you know, whenever Kobe passed away, at the beginning of February 2020 or something like that. And I was working jobs. Like, I used to be a residential and commercial painter. And I mean, if you know anything about painters, like, they're drinking on the job today as they're painting your house. Like, they're doing drugs in their truck. Like, no offense to the ones who don't do that and who I'm disparaging.
It's part of the culture,
but a good
maybe.
Portion of painters, and more so than even other trades. Like, I wouldn't know tile guys to do that or drywallers. A lot of painters I know are alcoholics. You know, you're alone in the house, and there's a lot of, you're surrounded by other alcoholics. So there's just beer on the job site. And so before I knew it, I was just drinking at work, and there was nothing unusual about that. And I think the thing that kind of made me kind of think about it one time was, now I'd already had the DUI at this point, and I'd had an impaired driving ticket from almost 10 years prior. So the DUI was my first DUI, but according to the law, that's like two within 10 years. So the license suspension, all that came with that DUI. So after I had kind of, I was drinking on the job one day and I was trying to leave work, and I knew I was too drunk to drive home. And that was the first time that that had ever happened to me. Like, it's 4 o'clock. All my coworkers just drove away from this development, and I'm sitting here because, like, I can't, if I get another DUI, it's a felony. So, like, I was kind of responsible in those regards. Like, even when I was drinking, I was never going to drink and drive again, right? But yeah, I sat there, in this house, and there's, like, no heat. It's just a, like, an unfinished house, and we're painting it, and I'm just, like, sitting there, and it's freezing cold, and I'm like, okay, things are getting kind of out of control. I was kind of working with like IOP, intensive mm-hmm. outpatient therapy, and I mean, I was a habitual screw up, right? And I was very manipulative with my therapist and with my caseworkers. So in maybe a year period or like an 8 month period, I didn't pass a single drug test, or if I did pass, because I would say, okay, the weed's gonna stay in my system for 4 to 6 weeks. So I literally cannot do this or I'm going to get in trouble. So maybe I would have the self-control not to do that, but I would be drinking. And then they started testing for something called creatinine, mm-hmm. Where it's, I think it's a protein that's created by your body when it breaks down alcohol. And the creatinine stays in your system for like 5 days, 3 to 5 days. And I was being drug tested twice a week. So it's like, I failed. My therapist pulled me in one time, right before I was sent to rehab for the second time. And she was like, I kind of blame myself for this because I've never held you accountable. Like, do you know you haven't passed a drug test for alcohol since you've been in intensive outpatient? And a lot of people, when they fail one test, we report them to their parole or probation officer, or they're back in treatment or whatever. And so the second time I went back to treatment was actually required by my therapist through IOP.
Okay.
Yeah, so neither time I went was it like a really well thought out decision. It was kind of either forced upon me, or I was trying to make my case with the DUI go a little bit better, or maybe convince my girlfriend that I cared enough to stop drinking when I didn't. I always kind of thought, like, I'm either going to lie to you and get away with it, or you're going to accept it. But quitting alcohol is not on the table. And it wasn't like I was aggressively thinking that. I was just like, well, there's these two options.
Pick one.
Yeah, pick one. I can either lie to you, or you can accept that I drink. And obviously you're not going to accept that I drink. And I'm a good liar, I thought. I'm actually a terrible liar.
So you go to rehab for the second time, and does something switch in you?
Yeah, so the staff said I was quite different. I still have all my journals from the second time.
Same rehab.
Yeah, same rehab. The first time I went, I think I did some journaling. I kind of took some notes and stuff like that. But the second time I went in, I was like, you know, and this is 2020. So this is only 4 years ago. I'm 36. So 32, you'd like to think you have some common sense.
I went at 45.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. The ball was kind of starting to drop, right? Like, mm-hmm. I was kind of starting to realize, okay, dude, two DUIs. You never passed a test in IOP. You're just going to be like your dad, you know what I mean? And God bless my dad. We don't talk that much, you know what I mean? But I saw my dad in myself. For a long time, he sat alone in a house in Dublin drinking by himself while his grandkids were being born, you know, while his kids are growing up. And he has never really gotten to see that. And my sisters have been really good about going home and seeing him. And I think he's a good man, you know what I mean? And I think in a lot of ways, without getting too deep into it, I think he really regrets his decisions in his life. And I saw myself turning into my dad. And I really was in love with this girl that I was engaged to when I went to rehab. And I kept on hearing my dad's voice. He told me this story about my mom one time. When my mom left to America with my sisters and I, and my dad would go down to the pub, they would always say, "Ah, Fran, where's the one with the green eyes?" You know, like my mom has these beautiful green eyes. And so I always just heard my dad's voice talking about my mom and how much I know my dad loved my mom, but he lost her, you know? And I just saw the parallels in my own situation. So I took it a lot more seriously the second time I went into treatment. Like I said, I got even worse after I got out, but while I was in there, I definitely felt like I was onto something. I was journaling a lot. I was trying to feel some sense of spirituality, but I was still kind of afraid to open my heart really to God. That second time was pretty incredible. I've gone back and read some of my journal entries, and they're, I can tell now that some of those journal entries were because I wanted my girlfriend to read the journal. Right. And I wanted, or my
like
fiance,
you're writing a letter to her.
Yeah. Kind of like I'm going to be really profound in these writings so that in a month when I'm out of here and I can show her my journals, it's almost like a progress report.
You know, that's manipulating, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Totally disingenuous. Yeah. My mom used to call me a master manipulator. I don't love that, but, and I think I've tried to really change those ways, but yeah, no, very, very manipulative my whole life. Kind of just disingenuous. I think always really concerned with just getting what I wanted and not really worrying about other people.
So you get out of rehab the second time.
Yeah.
How's that go?
Yeah. So I met a really cool guy in rehab, and I tried to not, no offense to anybody, but like I always kind of tried to keep my distance from people in treatment, while I was in treatment, but I knew you don't really associate with, you know, people that you've met in treatment right after you get out, right? That's kind of a bad idea. But I met this really cool guy, super smart guy, amazing artist, like handsome, 6'2", articulate, like just really, I mean, sound like I was in love with him or something, but he was just this incredibly impressive human being. He could dance, right?
And it's okay to have a man crush.
Yeah, I had a man crush.
Dr. Matt has one on me.
Yeah, I don't blame him. But just this super cool guy, and I was like, I could be friends with this guy. Like, this guy's cool, you know? And he had a problem, you know? He had a problem. He had a wife and a baby, and he was always different with me than he was with them, you know? I saw him kind of being this real toxic, kind of hateful person with his family, and that's not what I saw. But eventually, you know, it kind of got worse and worse and worse. And I think I was drinking for maybe about, so I went to rehab first December 2019, got out, relapsed, went back to treatment, I think in that fall, so August, September 2020, drank all the way through to the summer of 2021. And that's when I got in a really, really bad, like a heated argument with my fiance. And we were kind of broken up, kind of together. I had driven over to her house to get some like belongings, and we had gotten into it like an altercation out in the street, and the police were called, and I was actually charged with domestic violence, which I ended up pleading down to a disorderly conduct. But they kind of try to throw the book at you, I think, you know, and see what they can get to stick. But because of the circumstances of that, we went from basically trying to make things work to having the government like place a no contact order between us. So I went from basically being engaged to this beautiful woman to the very next day, the police are telling me, "Hey, if you text her, I love you, we're going to come pick you up, take you to jail for violating this no contact order." Things kind of really went off the rail for her. She's got her own addiction problems. A couple months after that, she ended up moving out to Minnesota, and you know, I mean, I talked to her yesterday, like on the phone. We're still good friends. I love her a lot, but that was it. You know, that was the moment the ball finally dropped for me, when I just realized, okay, the state's involved. I can't tell the person that I love them, or I'm gonna go to jail. And so I was lucky enough. It was right before the weekend of the 4th of July, 2021. It's like June 30th. And actually, like, no, so that was it. That whole situation with the no contact order was like the end of May 2021. So we didn't talk for, we didn't talk for months, obviously. But in the middle of May, one day I was like out drinking seltzers in the sunlight, smoking cigarettes, just being disgusting. And like the heat and the lukewarm seltzer and the cigarette, like just you're feeling hot and sweaty and gross. And impulsively, my mom, well, Alamo always has this amazing 4th of July celebration. It's next level for such a small town. The fireworks display, everybody gets out there. Like, somebody has a board with 100 squares on it and a chicken, and there's chicken wire
whoever
around
poops
it,
on it.
Whoever poops on the square. So
wins.
Super cool. You buy a raffle, right? But it's this really, really comforting place for me. It's very nostalgic. It reminds me of my childhood and like feeling safe. And kind of on a whim, I just called my mom. I was drunk. And I was like, "Hey, I'm thinking about coming down for the 4th of July. How do you feel about that?" And my ex had blocked my mom, and my mom and my ex were like so close, like birds of a feather, seriously. And my mom was she was like, "I think that's a pretty good idea. I think you should come down, stay for as long as you can, and we'll kind of take care of you." And I kind of had the luxury of doing that because I feel like I got to go on this like mini retreat. I went down to the desert. I brought a vape, right? Because I needed something, but like no cigarettes, no alcohol, nothing like that. And I went down there and I just sweated. I worked on the land. I cut a bunch of trees down for my mom. I went and I think I played some music at the 4th of July at this like cowboy poetry thing. I don't do cowboy poetry, but there's like a cowboy poetry thing. And I was like, whatever. It's cathartic. And so, but that was. I've shared that experience like with my roommates and with other people that I, think could benefit from that sort of situation. And not everybody has the luxury to like basically go to a retreat. Not my mom lives in a double wide trailer, so it's not a retreat. But, I feel like it was a retreat. I feel like it was like you go out into the middle of the desert.
It was
you're just
a
gonna
retreat
work.
For you.
Yeah. You're just going to drink water.
It was
water.
A retrieve. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just going to take a break from life. And like I said, I mean, that was my first 24. My first 24 hours was when I was in Alamo. I flew down and was detoxing for a week.
I think it's interesting because you've been to rehab twice, and your sobriety journey really started outside of both of those.
Yeah.
And it was surrounded by people who love you.
Yeah.
A place where you felt safe.
Yeah.
But more importantly, this was the first time it was your choice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
really
profound.
And that's what I tell people all the time when they ask me about sobriety. And I go, does the person want it? Because that's the number one key factor. Does the person want it? If the person wants it, you can find it anywhere. Yeah. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this. I mean, it's great to get the help at the treatment centers. It's great to get help from your church. It's great to get help from all these other places. But if that person doesn't want help,
right,
it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And you said the first time you went to lessen the charges on the DUI. The second time you went is because your therapist told you. Yeah. This time you went because you wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I had lost everything to me. Like, they took my car. They took my license when I got my first DUI. I didn't even care. I was, like, driving on a suspended. But I didn't even care. That girl meant so much to me. You know what I mean? And I just really looked at the situation and I was like, neither of us want this. Like, we had a pretty bad argument yesterday. We've had a lot of arguments over the last 2-3 years. We'll be fine. But I realized that my actions and my addiction had put me into a place where the government was controlling my personal life. And that to me, for some reason, I don't know why, because I was on probation for years. I had therapists and all this stuff who had a level of control over me. But that was the first time when I was really like, dude, you just lost the best thing that ever happened to you. And that kind of helped me develop a philosophy that I've kind of shared with a few people. But it's either, in my opinion, I think you stop, let's just use drinking for an example. You either stop drinking before you lose everything, and then you stop drinking, which is what happened to me. Or I think the worst and the most unfortunate is you lose everything and you never stop.
Yeah.
And I think I would just, my message would just be just stop before you lose everything. You know what I mean?
We've talked about it on the podcast before, and it's a meme, and it says, I gave up everything for one thing.
Yeah.
Now all I have to do is give up one thing, and I get everything.
That's beautiful.
You know, and that's what it is. But, you know, that third part is the real kicker.
The tragedy.
Yeah. You know what? I lost everything, and I'm still drinking.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean?
And I'm still losing.
And I'm still losing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what have you learned in the past 3 years?
You know, I've probably learned more in the last 6 months than I've learned in the 2.5 years prior. I've learned that humility is really important and grace is really important. I've been given a lot of grace by people. I've avoided being homeless because of the grace of strangers, you know, and I've been able to, I've had people see me at my worst and they don't, that's not how they see me. You know, that's just, they recognize that as a moment or a period I was going through in my life. And I think it's just, I've learned that kindness and love are the most important things in this world. And it's just extremely important to be kind to people.
Dr. Matt, I want to ask you, humility. He's mentioned it many times. What does humility mean to you?
That's a great question. I think when a person has humility, they have a level of understanding and acceptance of all parts of themselves.
Would empathy be a key component to humility?
I think empathy probably is easier to have when you're humble. But I think humility doesn't, you know, it means you accept the fact that you have struggles, you have weaknesses. You also have to accept that you have strengths and abilities.
Is humility the opposite of ego?
Yeah, I mean, because, the way we use ego in that sense.
Because, you know, I think a lot of times that keep an addict in active addiction is ego. For many of us. You know, I can't say that. For me, it was.
No, I mean,
it was such that I'm Casey Scott. This doesn't happen to me. And if it is happening to me.
Well, your ego was so big that when the producer asked you if you were doing okay, you didn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is that I'm smarter than this. Right. And if it is a problem, I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And for me.
But there's no acceptance of those problems. That's why it's not humility. Humility is like, I accept my weaknesses. I understand I have them.
Yeah. And so for me, my humility was like, no, I cannot beat this. And the only way to beat this is to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to accept it because I wanted to be smarter than that. I wanted to be the guy that figured it out. I want, you know what I mean?
And well, ego strength versus like a narcissistic ego, those are different because when you're growing up and life is hard and you have challenges, you have to have ego strength. You have to believe in yourself. You have to be like, I'm the guy you can pass the ball to. I can do this, right? But that can get out of hand to where it becomes unhealthy.
Pass me the ball. Come on. I'm the only one that can do this.
Yeah. And then when it's I'm the only one,
yeah.
Now we're kind of crossed over into that kind of narcissistic ego place where we become blind to our weaknesses. We become blind to other people's role in our lives. We think we're, you know, a one-man show, which is never the case. Anytime someone's successful, there's a lot of people that play a role in that success.
You said... within the past maybe 6 months, maybe a year, you opened your heart and your soul and your mind to God. Was there a experience or was there a situation that led to that, or was it just something?
It was kind of a culmination, I think, of my whole life. I mean, I've had so many examples of faithful people in my life. I used to look at people with faith in God and Jesus with envy. I was never an atheist. I was never really agnostic or anything like that, but I had never received a personal testimony. And so I used to kind of look at people like, how did you get that? I wish I could believe that the story of Jesus was true. It sounds like such a cool story. And I feel like he's just like this really cool guy, but like, how do you know he's the Son of God? And like, without getting all into like, you know, too preachy or anything like that, it kind of dawned on me one day, like I'd kind of thought that God needed to come down and like smite me on the head, right? Or like appear to me, right? And like I'm special and like these other people, I don't really even know if that's real faith, but whatever. But it kind of hit me one day. I was like, is it just a choice? Like, is it a choice? And I kind of didn't like the way that sounded, you know, and I wrestled with that for a long time. And then I realized, like, there's a lot of freedom that comes with that choice, the choice to believe. And I wasn't sure what would happen. I kind of, the reason I didn't like that idea was because I was like, well, if you're choosing to believe in something, is that actually faith? Like, you know, that whole thing. And that's why I say, like, I've just been blown away by the blessings in my life over the last 6 months, because everything that's been happening to me is evidence of God and just the way he, I don't want to use the word reward because I don't want to make it seem like if you don't have enough faith, he won't reward you. But I feel like he will make himself known to you if you have that in your heart and you decide to give up maybe your rational or logical mind and you kind of think with more of your heart, I guess. I don't know.
No, I think that was beautiful.
Thank you.
You know, and I think if you open up your heart and your soul and your mind, I think God will show himself to you. And maybe he was always showing himself to you, but now you were just ready to see it.
Yeah. No, his
hand is
present.
Talked about your journey along the whole time of the grace and kindness of strangers and friends and family.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Who
were
there to protect you and keep you from homelessness and keep you from harm and be able to do these things for you.
Yeah. No, he was in my life the whole time. And I feel, you know, maybe it's the narcissist in me that I'm still trying to get rid of, but I truly feel like one of the most blessed people of all time. I feel like God, I mean, I don't even like the way that sounds, but I truly believe like I'm just so blessed and that God just, I mean, he loves us all equally, you know what I mean? So everyone has the opportunity to partake of the same blessings. But I just look back on my life and I think whether it was the missionary from, I mean, these missionaries were from Payson and from Idaho Falls, and them getting a call to serve their mission. One of them was actually killed on his mission. One of them was stabbed to death.
Oh,
you know
wow.
what I mean? And so like his sacrifice, you know, when he got his mission call and he decided to be faithful to his family and God and serve his mission, like, you know, and just things like that, or, you know, my mom meeting the Hardys, or, you know, getting kicked out of BYU Idaho, or like going through, I think that, I mean, my every trial I've been through in my life, and I can say this honestly, I swear to you, every trial I've ever been through in my life, I can look back on and I can see its purpose. And I can see that has brought me to where I am today, and it's given me the ability to even share this message, you know?
I think that's a beautiful thing, and that's the power of recovery. Give up one thing for everything, you know?
Yeah.
Get everything by giving up one thing.
Love it.
Dr. Matt, what do you think about Scott Devine's story?
Well, first of all, just thank you so much for coming to share your story with us. I think that's... I think we mentioned off air, like, I'm always impressed and appreciative that people would take time out of the middle of their day to come and, you know, share their story with us. I guess my takeaway thought is something that you said there at the end. It's kind of the difference between regretting our past or accepting and appreciating our past so that we can move forward. And it sounds like when you go through your past and you're thinking now about, you know, the trials and problems and setbacks that you had, that you're looking at it more with eyes of appreciation. I can see the purpose, like you said, in each of those things. And that's such a healthy way to look at our past, because all of us have things in our past that weren't pretty, that we regret, that we wish had been different. But if you can just bundle that into a appreciative eyes, you know, and look at it that way, it can empower you to keep moving forward in a good direction. So that's kind of my takeaway from your story today.
The thing I like about Scott's story, and I like a lot, is the fact that it reiterates the power of recovery. And the first thing is that he went to two different treatment facilities, neither one by his choice.
Right. That's a common story, right?
He got sober on his own accord.
Yeah.
But the things you learned in the first two were not lost on you. You know, and that's what people don't understand is like, you know, we've had people that have gone to 9 rehabs. We've had people that have gone to 12 rehabs. Yeah. There's still information being gained and collected.
A rehab master's degree.
Yeah, and putting in their tool belt.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure over the past 3 years of you getting sober by yourself after your reprieve back in your hometown, you were utilizing some of the stuff that you picked up in the treatment centers both times.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a huge advocate of group therapy. I got a lot out of one-on-one therapy for sure, but whether it was in treatment or whether it was in my IOP classes with a bunch of people, some of the best stories I've ever heard in my life were not from professionals. And some of the best advice I've ever heard has come from someone who's not even out of addiction, but them sharing their story has helped me open my eyes to be more grateful or thank God that I haven't been through more and been through worse, because I've made it through this relatively unscathed, you know what I mean? Even at my lowest points, and things got pretty bad. And unfortunately, I had to lose someone really close to me. And this, we never got around to it, but the guy I was telling you about, the guy I had a man crush on, he died while I was in Alamo during those 6 days. And I don't know why that happened. Sometimes I think maybe it had to be either him or I. Maybe I had to die and then he would have got sober, or maybe he had to die, and maybe that has nothing to do with anything. But during those first days I was sober, I lost someone who was a really close friend to me, and he died of alcohol-induced, like a seizure, just at work that he had, because he was trying to get sober and he couldn't. And, I've made it, God willing, like I've made it through, you know, without burning too many bridges, right? Without destroying anything permanently, hopefully. And, I'm so grateful to be here. And I really think that, just to piggyback off what you were saying, like, those lessons in treatment were not lost on me. Like I spent Christmas in a residential facility and had to like turn over and look at the brick wall like it was jail and be like, what are you doing, man? Like, think about your life, dude.
Well, I mean, you're sober today, God willing, and because you did the work and you chose to, and you fought for your life. And for that, we're very appreciative that you'll stop by and share your story. Scott, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you guys for listening to another episode of Project Recovery, brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery. For more information, check them out, reprieverc.com. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what?
It's a KSL podcast.
I go home and check on my painters.
Good idea. Good idea.
Look in their 5-gallon bucket. Yeah. They got some beer. They got some beer in there.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I'm happy to say our podcast, Project Recovery, is sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. Reprieve is a women's only center located in Mountain Green, Utah. Find out more on their website at reprieverc.com.